tonight's talk is a bit of an experiment. So I'm not quite sure how it will turn out, which is a little bit of anxiety producing. But actually, when I chatted with Gil before, as we talked about my coming here, he thought it would be helpful if I would at least start where I'm going to start, and we'll see where it goes. So recently, at the end of March, I attended a conference at Pendle Hill. And Pendle Hill, as some of you probably know well, is a large Quaker conference center outside of Philadelphia. And it's a place where I teach fairly regularly and have for a number of years now, and very much enjoy being there and participating in the Quaker practice as well as in the Buddhist practice. And this conference was a conference for Quakers who consider themselves to be Buddhists, which it's possible to do in the Quaker world. It might be a little trickier in some of the other Western worlds, but it is possible as a Quaker. And I went along partly because I was interested and also because I'd been invited to attend as a Buddhist teacher who teaches in the Quaker world to kind of provide that piece of the picture. So let me read you a little bit from one of the sheets that came out to us before the workshop. It was a workshop for friends who have already read a great deal of Buddhist thought or who practice Buddhist meditation or have taken Buddhism into their personal spiritual path in some significant way. And it was not designed to be an academic kind of thing, and we combined both Buddhist and Quaker worship. And we looked at points of confluence and mutual support in Buddhism and Quakerism, as well as perceived points of irreconcilable differences. We actually didn't find very many of those. So since this is a friend's meeting house, and when I happened to mention to Gil that I'd been doing that, he thought, oh good, why don't you talk about it? It would be helpful to share a little about what that interface is about. And this is very much part of my own exploration right now of how to integrate some of my relationship to my own Christian background and Christian roots. Some of you know Sylvia Boorstein fairly well, and you know that Sylvia has made quite a serious practice in recent years of integrating her Jewish background and Jewish roots into her Buddhist practice, and even as we speak is teaching a retreat, several weeks of retreat actually, in a Jewish meditation center in the East Coast. And I suspect, if I look around the room and see that most of us are of a certain age, that there aren't too many of us who were raised Buddhist. Is this true? Is there anybody who was? Yeah, right. All right. Yeah. A little closer. Yeah. Once in a while now, we are encountering people who are young enough and whose parents were in the very, very early Western Buddhist group of practitioners. So occasionally we have people in our groups who are raised Buddhist. And I actually have one elderly friend who was raised as a Buddhist in pre-Hitler Germany. But she's a pretty unusual being. Pretty unusual being. My own story, just so you'll know a little of what the picture is that I bring to this, is that I was born into an East Coast intellectual, somewhat socialist, communist family. Neither parent attended church at all, and in fact, my mother, I think to this day, is firmly convinced that religion is the opiate of the masses. And sometimes it is. And so they were not very interested in giving me any kind of religious training. And interestingly enough, I arrived drawn to it, and I have no idea. We can make up lots of stories, you know, past lives, who knows what. And, you know, usually somebody comes up and says, oh, yes, I'm sure you were a Catholic nun at least once. It's probably true, because what happened was, in fact, I ended up raising myself Catholic secretly. I was absolutely convinced. This started very young. I was very drawn to it, even when, you know, little girls would be wearing their little white First Communion veils and dresses, and oh, I wanted one of those. And I loved the statues of the Blessed Mother outside of the churches. And gradually, I learned how to say different prayers. I found the Hail Mary in the encyclopedia. And I collected little, you know, Christmas cards with religious images on them after my parents were done with them. I'd fish them out of the wastebasket. And I hid them. And then on Sunday morning, I'd sort of, before they got up, I'd create a little altar and I'd say my prayers. And I didn't, I knew if I told them, I had this idea that they would disown me. I'm not sure I knew what being disowned meant, but I was sure that that's what would happen. And that didn't seem like a very good idea, so I kept it secret. And actually, it was probably wise that I did, because it would have upset them, and I don't know what they would have done about it. It might have created a great deal of conflict. So that went on for a number of years. When I was about 17, actually, there was a shift that happened, and I realized that I wasn't likely to be able to keep all of the rules. This is in the 50s. On the East Coast. So Catholicism at that point was still pretty strict. You know, before John the 23rd, things hadn't changed very much. So I ended up becoming an Episcopalian instead when I finally came out of the closet, one step removed. And I did that very happily for a number of years, and then got involved in a group that some of you may know about called the Guild for Psychological Studies, which is based up in San Francisco and is interested in the interface between Jungian psychology and Western spiritual practices. And that began to shift things for me. I was really wanting to know more about prayer and contemplation. I'd always been very drawn to that. And it was very difficult to find out very much about prayer and contemplation in the Catholic Church and in any of the Western churches in the 50s and early 60s. And then as I sort of began to move away from the church, at some point in the very early 80s, turned out that Jack was offering a workshop at the Transpersonal Psychology Conference in Asilomar, and by then I had become a therapist and was interested. I realized I still was very closeted in terms of my spirituality, and I wanted to kind of come out a little bit more, and I went to his workshop and fell in love, really, was what happened, and discovered that here were some people who knew something about prayer and contemplation in a way that they could teach to lay people. And I didn't make a big distinction in my own heart mind between meditation and prayer and contemplation. And that's an interesting point, actually. So that's my own story in a nutshell. And as it has shifted over the years, my own sense has been that it's gradually become the arena in which I play has become bigger and bigger and bigger. So each one of us has that question. Each one of you has some kind of relationship to the religion in which you were raised, or to the fact that you were not raised in any, as I was. And that relationship varies probably considerably amongst you. Some of you have undoubtedly turned your backs on it completely and don't want to have anything to do with it. Some of you are probably still practicing in the Jewish tradition or the Hindu tradition or the Christian tradition or as Quakers or whatever it is that you are in some of the other parts of your inner and spiritual life. And so it's an interesting question about, are these different practices that have been at least part of our past, if not part of our present, what is our relationship to them at this point in our lives? What do we do with them? One of the things I like about working with the friends is that they have a practice of what they call queries. And so queries are questions that are raised about spiritual practices, and they're not intended necessarily to have an answer that is any one right answer. It's more a question to kind of get you to think. And so some queries were formulated before we went into the conference. So here are some of the ones that we worked with. How do you reconcile a Quaker religion? And you could probably pretty much substitute Christian religion for those of you who are Christian or Jewish, that has been historically theistic, dualistic, revealed, and ethnocentric, with a Buddhist philosophy that has been historically agnostic, non-dualistic, self-revealing, and universal. What are the similarities and differences in your Buddhist and your Quaker thought and practices? So you can fill in that with whatever your own personal practices are or were. Are there any perceived areas of difficulty in putting the two together, e.g., God, sayings of Jesus, sayings of the Buddha, role of the teacher? What different perspective does Buddhist and Quaker thought have on the role of prayer in your daily spiritual practice? What do you do during meeting for worship? Buddhist practice, Quaker worship, or what? Are there Buddhist principles that support or in conflict with our manner of meetings for worship, meetings for business, etc.? And what are the Buddhist principles supporting Quaker testimonies of simplicity, equality, community, and nonviolence? So these are interesting questions. Some of them are more Quaker questions than Buddhist questions. And some things occur to me to say as comments and perhaps to raise more questions. One is that the Buddha actually never said there isn't a God. He just said that thinking about where this all came from, how it got created, is there a God, is an unthinkable. And he said it's not one of the things that is going to help very much in ending suffering. And that's a very interesting place. He doesn't say don't. He just says it's not very useful. It's not necessary. It's not required. So that's one place. Another place he says, And several people mentioned this at the weekend, he's talking about Nibbana. Now, Nibbana is pretty interesting. He says there is an unborn, an unbrought to being, an unmade, an unformed. If there were not, there would be no escape made known here for one who is born, brought to being, made, formed. But since there is an unborn, an unbrought to being, an unmade, an unformed, an escape is therefore described for one who is born, brought to being, made, and formed. Interestingly enough, someone at that weekend brought this quote from an anonymous Scottish Quaker of the 17th century, who said, in stillness is fullness, in fullness is emptiness, in emptiness are all things. So what you begin to see are some parallels when we start talking about direct experience. Now, one of the things that I've always loved about the Buddha's teachings, and many, many people point to this when they talk about what they like about the Buddha's teachings, is the Buddha's stress on the importance of direct experience. He absolutely says you should not take anything purely on belief. And he even sat there and said, don't believe me, the Buddha. You know, try it out for yourself. Every one of us who ever sits up in front of you to teach should probably say the same thing. Don't believe a word I say. Please, don't. I'm not that trustworthy. I don't know that much. I have some ideas. I've learned a few things. The Buddha had a lot more ideas. He'd learned a lot more. But nonetheless, what's important is that you find out for yourself. Test everything. Everything. Test it. And that's what he said to do. He said, in those days, you would test a coin to see if it was gold by biting into it. And if when you bit into the coin, you left teeth marks, then that let you know that the metal was soft enough so that there was gold in it. If there weren't any teeth marks, it probably wasn't gold. And he said, you should do that with all of these teachings. Test them, bite into them, chew on them a little bit. See how they work for you. See what is true for your own being. And that was true in my group in Santa Cruz. We've been actually working, some of us, with this book on the life of the Buddha. And in the very, very beginning of his practice, when he left and before his enlightenment, when he went out to study with the different monks, he wanted direct experience. He didn't want to take anything on belief. So it was that stance has been with him right from the beginning. And there are those, I think, in all traditions who stress the experience of the sacred rather than any kind of belief that's based on what other people have said. And when the people who are interested in direct experience of from the different traditions come together to have conversations, I think that's when we find we have something to say to each other. One of the people I've been reading quite a bit recently is an Episcopal bishop who's teaching at Harvard right now. His name is Bishop Spahn. Some of you may know about him. And Bishop Spahn has been known to say that he doesn't know how he could be a Christian if he weren't a Buddhist. He's written a book called Why Christianity Must Change or Die. This has not made him terribly popular in certain groups. And he's made a very interesting comment, which I think comes in this place where that the Buddha points to. His comment is that most Western theology was formulated at a time when we considered the best scientific minds of the time considered that the earth was flat, that there was a shell up over it that had stars in it. On the other side of the shell, there was this being who made decisions for all of us. Down underneath the flat was something you didn't want to think about very much, and it wasn't very nice. And that was the model of the cosmos. And that's how they understood their physical reality to be. And the theology grew out of that model of the cosmos and reflects that model of the cosmos. Well, you know, we know that that is no longer true. And so as I read him, I was very interested to see, and there are other Christian thinkers also who are writing similar things, that they're beginning to sound, some of these people, I'm not talking about right-wing Christianity here, but some of these people are beginning to sound remarkably Buddhist in their ideas about how things are. So that's one thing to consider. Another is, I decided that in my search for information to put into this conversation that I was hoping to have around the interface of Buddhist practice and Christian practice, and mind you, it's actually been canceled at this point, but we were planning on having a retreat at Spirit Rock that was going to be a retreat specifically for Christian and Jewish clergy. to be held in June. Unfortunately, we didn't get as much sign up because we didn't advertise it soon enough, so it's not happening. But it will happen sooner or later. And so these conversations are happening. And I decided I would read some Christian mystics, and I picked up a book by a woman whose name is Evelyn Underhill, who was writing at the beginning of the last century and has written a lot about Western mysticism. And I just want to read you a few lines from here and there. This is a book called Practical Mysticism, and so it's Instructions for Practice. So here she's talking about what happens in the mind. And she says, none is condemned, save by his own pride, to the horrors which Blake called single vision, perpetual and undivided attention to the continuous movie performance which the mind has conspired with the senses to interpose between ourselves and the living world. Now, I've heard things almost exactly like that from Joseph Goldstein about how the mind is this ongoing story and movie that we pay attention to instead of giving our attention to our direct experience. Or here's another. So this is more about bare attention. She's talking about to the contemplation of pure form, freed from all the meanings with which the mind has draped and disguised it. The recapturing of the lost mysteries of touch and fragrance, most wonderful among the avenues of sense. You can tell that she was writing at the beginning of the last century. So she's saying what we need to do in our practice, she's giving instructions to Westerners who are trying to do Western mystical practice, is get back to bare attention, just the hearing, just the seeing, just the smelling, just the touching, exactly the instructions. I was astonished when I read this book. This woman is giving, she could sit up in front and teach a Vipassana retreat, and she'd be just fine. And you'd all enjoy it, probably. And at the end, she says, the result of practice, the doors of perception are cleansed, and everything appears as it is. Right out of the suttas, practically. Amazing, huh? So you have people like that. You have other people. You have Angela Silesius, who's an old friend, and was I think he's a Protestant mystic, actually. He says, God, whose love and joy are present everywhere, can't come to visit you unless you aren't there. And Jacob Burma, who's another Protestant mystic, says, God is the nothing that wants to become something. So you have in these people, or in Meister Eckhart, who certainly over and over again sounds enormously Buddhist, you have these statements reflecting some kind of direct experience of the sacred, whatever that is. And mostly in people who are of a more mystical bent in the Western world, they know that what this experience is ultimately unknowable or unthinkable, just as the Buddha said. And in fact, they're called mystics because it's the same root as the word mystery. It can't be known. It's a mystery. So I think what this points toward for all of us who come from our various backgrounds is that it's possible for us to begin, if you're interested, for those of you who are still trying to create some sense of peace or reconciliation with what your roots are and where you are now. So there's really, I think, a very broad platform for some exploration of what this might be. And in fact, what some people I know refer to as the G word, the God word, turns out and certainly in some conversations, and certainly at this conference that I attended, not to be so much of an obstacle. As soon as we began to discuss what the experience was, then it didn't seem as though it was much of a barrier in Christian practice or Quaker practice and Buddhist practice. One of the things I've been thinking about a lot in my own life recently are what I call experiential koans or life koans. Most of you know that in the Zen world, in Rinzai Zen, there are koans, and a koan is a kind of a riddle or a question to which there is no simple rational answer. So a very well-known one is, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Or what was your face before you were born? And, you know, how do you answer those things? And they're designed to be that way, so that the thinking mind kind of bashes up against this impossible question over and over and over again until it collapses. And then some more intuitive, non-rational kind of answer emerges. Well, we're all old enough to know that there's lots of questions like that in life, right? There are things that come along that don't have a simple answer, and we get to sit with them. You know, it might be something that your teenage daughter is doing, or it might be something that your 87-year-old mother is doing, or it might be something about your own relationship life or your work or whatever. And there isn't one simple answer. There may not even be a rational answer. And sometimes the practice with a koan is to let it sit there and resonate until things shift and something moves. Recently, just 2 weeks ago, I was down in Baja sea kayaking, which was a great treat. And the conjunction of the sea and the desert were just that. It was so utterly impossible to think that these two things could be there together. The cactus and the rocks and the scorpions and the desert that has not seen rain for 3 years, right next to all this water, seaweed, fishes, lobsters, dolphins, and all the watery abundance, neither of which could really affect the other. And there wasn't any way. It was one of those things where the mind just couldn't and can't yet take it in, and so you just sit with the question that it poses. Well, I tell you this because I think it's a helpful way to work with these questions about what do we do with the remnants of what we were raised with, whether they're remnants that are still very alive and well, or remnants that you don't pay too much attention to, but they surface once in a while. They may surface purely as reactivity to what comes your way, what you read in the paper, or you go and you have Thanksgiving with your mother or your father or somebody, and all that old family stuff comes up again, whatever those old family practices were. And so is there a way to hold them in our Buddhist practice, what for many of us is now our central practice in our lives, and let them simply be there, whatever the questions are? What do I do about prayer? What do I do about this word that we call God, whatever that is? What do I do about fill in the blank? And let them resonate in our being and see where it takes us without having to come to a conclusion. My own sense for myself was that, you know, the 6-year-old, 10-year-old, 12-year-old Mary created, actually, if I look back on it, a fairly rigid kind of religious world. But it worked for a kid that young. And then it expanded, and then it expanded, and then it expanded. So each time, as things have shifted, there's been some opening and there's been some more space. I'd like to think this is a good thing, that it's possible to be more and more spacious. And so I invite you to consider that for yourself. Is there a way that you can work with your own practices, past and present, in order to open into the spaciousness which ultimately, we hope, would be the spaciousness of the Buddha? So I think that's enough for me. I really invite questions and comments tonight because, as I said at the beginning, this is very much a thinking in process. And I hope I haven't offended anyone. And I'm really interested to hear your questions and comments. Please.
Jerry, first of all, thank you very much for your topic. It's really important to me anyway, for your brothers. My question is, can you go back to this first comment regarding what Buddha had said about the relationship with God? And it almost seemed like Buddha was being dismissive of the God project and being critical. It sounds like not very Buddhist of Buddha, but you have to be very compassionate to God believers. Could you like elucidate on what Buddha...
I don't think I can find it immediately in the text, but he essentially said that he was dealing with the there are four unthinkables. One is where this all comes from. One is all the karma that brings us to this particular moment. One is the nature of the mind of a Buddha, and I think the other one is what happens to a Buddha after he dies, but I might be wrong on that one. So these are kind of speculative, metaphysical questions, which cannot be answered by this puny little 4 inches of gray matter. And actually, some people who are theistic won't go for this, but some people agree that if you can, for example, if you could think God, I mean, then is it God if you can think it? I tend to think not, actually. So what he's saying is this is impossible to think. We can't come close. And if you spend a lot of time trying to think it, it is not going to come to an end of suffering. The image he gave was an image of a poisoned arrow. And he said, it's as though you're shot with a poisoned arrow. You are suffering big time. But do you pull the arrow out? No. You say, I want to know where the arrow came from, and I'd like to know what kind of wood it's made out of, and I'd like to know what exactly is the nature of the poison, and who fired the arrow anyway. And so you have all these questions that are maybe impossible to know, and you get your suffering, dying maybe. He says, pull out the arrow. That's all. So that was the thrust of his teaching, was that it was possible to be here as a human being and not to suffer, and that I come to teach the nature of suffering and the end of suffering. That was the thrust of his teaching, and the other stuff was not so interesting. It wasn't the sense I get is not that it was dismissive, it's just not what his perceived job was, and he felt that he could teach people how not to suffer. Now, whether he could see more than that, I mean, there's the whole other thing of, you know, the leaves in the forest, you know, the image where all the leaves, the mind of the Buddha and the knowledge of the Buddha is as many as all of the leaves in the forest, but he picks up a handful. This is what I can teach you. And the other stuff isn't teachable.
He never as much gave an opinion, though, about no. What he believed in God.
No.
God.
No, so far as I know, no.
Okay, thanks.
Please.
Well, in that context, I wonder, I mean, since primarily most of us are here to study Buddhism, and since looking at history, we can see that this generality creates nothing but immense pain and suffering. I mean, mm-hmm. killing more people than practically anything else, creating so much division and hatred and all. I mean, why look at it in terms of trying to incorporate it rather than expel it? It is the poison.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with you. I think there are people throughout history who have held it. My own observation would be primarily from a fairly rigid belief-based, we're right and you're wrong, and that's what creates the suffering. There are also people who have held it in a different way, in which there has been a great deal less suffering. And so I'm not sure that whether there's a God or not is the cause of the suffering. But how that question is held can be quite tricky. I'm interested in it because my sense is that there are people, such as the group that I was with, and I've run into any number of other people, and there are probably some of you here, who are still doing some of the practices from their past and who still have some sense. There are certainly many Buddhists I run into who certainly will not take a stance that there absolutely is not a God. They might be a little, maybe so, maybe no. One of my teachers said to me once, my friend Hamid Ali, who teaches up in Berkeley in this Ridwan School, was the founder. I used to call him my psychoanalytic Reikian Buddhist Sufi because it about covered the territory. And so somebody said, well, Hamid, what about God? And Hamid said, well, whatever is, is. Maybe, and then he laughed, he said, maybe today it's God, and next week it's the void. And the week after that, it's something else. Who knows? We can't know. What's important is that we live in a way that is as kind and compassionate and sees as clearly as possible. That we know. And I don't think that's exclusive to Buddhists, actually. So, please, David.
I think at the beginning of Nikaya, the Buddha, he essentially said that there's a being that considers itself to be God, but only because in the rebirth of the universe, it was a being of great merit that was born first, and so lives under the belief.
And if you, I do, and what it reminds me of, for some of you may have read the translation that Ajahn Amaro did recently of the Pilgrim Camminita, which is a Buddhist romance. So if you would like a novel which will also teach you a great deal about Buddhism, you can get it for free by writing to the monastery, and they'll send you a copy. It's reviewed in the current copy of The Inquiring Mind if you want to read a review. And in there, that particular deity does show up, I believe, who thinks he's God, he, she, he, I think. But who knows? Yeah, who knows? Who knows? Please.
Yeah, it's sort of bouncing off of that question, I'd have to veer a little bit towards the Hindu, or at least my understanding of the Hindu concept of God, which is that, you know, God isn't a being.
Mm-hmm.
God
mm-hmm.
is consciousness.
Right.
And
Actually, there's some very interesting writing. There's a fellow by the name of Marcus Borg, who's up in Portland, who talks a lot about God as ground. And Bishop Spong also talks about that, and so did Paul Tillich. So ground in the sense of that emptiness from which all arises. Now, this does really begin to sound Buddhist. And it isn't God as a being kind of tinkering around, you know, adjusting things at all. So there certainly is some thinking in that direction, yeah. Let me get this person here and then.
Let me see if I can articulate this well. I don't understand how you couldn't, in your particular workshop,
huh?
there were some very big irreconcilable differences, because it seems to me that if you're a real practicing Christian or Jewish person, then you buy into the theology and the history in which God said certain things, and that's meant, and he said you should behave in certain ways, or as prophets did, mm-hmm. wisdom. And you could argue around the fringes of that, but there's a sort of a history that, by and large, is pretty much accepted by...
But less and less so, because the history is more and more, in some realms, not in all. And of course, in the Quaker world, and I don't know, there may be some Quakers in here who could speak to this better than I, you have quite a range of Quakers. And any Quaker who already holds themselves to be both a Buddhist and a Quaker is in that more flexible, fringy place already. It's true. I mean, the people, we did not get, for example, really strongly Christocentric, theocentric Quakers.
I'm not Christian myself, but I don't understand, I have friends who are, how you can be Christian without believing in Christ, the Son of God.
Well, this is an interesting question. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, and there are certainly groups of Christians where that would not be true. And then there are people who are beginning to say, well, wait a minute, maybe what this is about, what happened, is understandable by looking at it differently. If you want to read something kind of interesting, read Bishop Spong's book, because he takes on exactly that question. I'm not here to persuade you all to be Christians. Please. You know, I am happily a Buddhist. I intend to stay a Buddhist. I'm interested in this conversation, and Gil thought you would be interested to hear about it a bit, to stir up your own. But I'm certainly not trying to persuade you that it's important to take that in. I'm more interested in... One of my friends actually said to me, he said, I actually think maybe the Buddhists have a little more to teach the Quakers, teach the Christians, than the Christians have to teach the Buddhists. I don't know whether that's really true or not. There may be some places of dialogue that can go both ways about some things, maybe just how it is to be a spiritual community in the West, if nothing else. But it's an interesting comment. So, let's see, you had a question, then we'd better stop because it is 9 o'clock.
An interesting book called The Gnostic Gospel.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
And what her thesis is that there were the various teachings of Christ that were much more individual investigation of spiritual issues. And that the early Christian church essentially suppressed that part of the teaching and kept the part of the teaching which was much more hierarchical in order to establish
it. And there's a great deal of biblical criticism these days that points towards that, and that there may have been even understandings about what the nature of what happened to the person Jesus is. I mean, there's the church has taught one kind of thing, but it's not necessarily what actually happened. Who knows what happened? Many Buddhists consider him to be a bodhisattva. You know? All right. Maybe one more, and then we really will stop.
Do you smell the name of this bishop?
Spong. S as in Sam. P as in Peter. O-N-G. Yeah. Spong. All right. What I usually do, can you catch me afterwards?
Well, I think this is more a koan for everything else.
Okay, please.
I think a lot of people come here from the Catholic background and Jewish background. My father was a Baptist, a Southern Baptist, and my mother was a Southern Methodist, and they compromised on a very right-wing Christian church in Southern California, and that's where I come from, and because of that, this is purely an academic
thing. Uh-huh, right.
There's just no way.
Yeah, I think that's true. In those much more rigid churches, it would be really hard to have much of a dialogue. Yeah. All right. Well, enjoy your thinking. Would be happy to hear from any of you one way or another if you have some thoughts about where I can take my own thinking. If you want me to... There might be some comments I wouldn't want to hear. But we'll see. If Gil calls me and says, well, you're not coming back to Palo Alto. So I thank you very much for your patience. I promise next time I'll give you a much more Buddhist talk. And let's end with a little bit of loving kindness practice just for a second, because this is how I like to end my sitting. So stay seated, just exactly the position you're in. There's nothing formal. Let your attention come to your own being. Be aware of your body and as it sits or relaxes or stands. Consider your own situation, your work, your family, what happened today, what will happen to tomorrow, and if there, what you think might happen tomorrow, and if there is any kind thought which you would like to send to yourself, any way in which you can hold your being in the context of your life with some kindness. And for some of you, it might just be having the idea that this might be possible. That's as far as you can go with it. That's great if you can get that far. For some of you, it might be a full-fledged phrase of, may I find peace at that meeting tomorrow, or may there be healing in my relationship, or whatever. Left, in front of you and behind you. Perhaps some sense of appreciation for how we support each other's practice by gathering here in this way. Let your awareness go on out into the world, perhaps towards people whom you know and love, sending those people kindness, wishes for happiness and well-being and awakening. And then let our kindness go out into the world to all people, to all the creatures of the earth and the air and the water. And may any merit that comes from our practice together this evening, may this merit be of benefit to all beings, that all beings everywhere may be happy, may be peaceful, and may be free. So thank you very much for your presence and your practice, and I'll look forward to seeing you again.